It's time for the writers, our annual, our weekly look at what is new in the world of books. And tonight, Ceridwen Dovey is my guest. Her book, Life After Truth, takes us to a Harvard reunion back at one of the world's most extraordinary universities, a place where she herself studied. And the other week I was watching The Social Network. I don't know whether you saw that film, the Aaron Sorkin written film about Mark Zuckerberg, how he created Facebook in a dorm at Harvard. It's actually set in this same period. And there's even a reference to Natalie Portman studying there at the time. And it's an extraordinary place, just the architecture, the beautiful buildings, the tradition, the finals club, it's a sense of history that's there. Mark Zuckerberg ended up leaving early and founding Facebook over in California. But it seems like an extraordinary world and an extraordinary privilege to get to study there. It is, you know, it's an extraordinary brand name and not many Australians get to go there. Some great writers who've been there include Margaret Atwood, William S. Burroughs, Matt Damon and Natalie Portman went there. All in all, an extraordinary place. And one Harvard alum, one of the many writers to graduate from Harvard, is Ceridwen Dovey. She was in the class of 2003, the same intake year, in fact, as Natalie Portman and Jared Kushner. And this is the setting for her latest novel, which is about a group of old classmates returning to Harvard for a weekend reunion. And we know when there's a reunion, all the old tensions, all the old passions come out to play, don't they? The book is called Life After Truth. Ceridwen Dovey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dom.
Now, how did you end up in at Harvard? I gather it's quite difficult to get into.
I was lucky. My older sister, we were both studying at North Sydney Girls, and she had an American friend who happened to be applying to unis over there. And so she figured it all out. And then we hadn't even been to America. And she came to my parents one day and said, I've got into Harvard. And they said, well, that's not going to be possible financially. And she said, no, they've given me full financial aid to go. And so 2 years later, it was sort of monkey see, monkey do. And I had the benefit of her, you know, already being there. And we had 2 years where we overlapped on the campus.
How amazing. I imagine a lot of graduating students don't even think of trying to get into somewhere so famous and prestigious, and what the path even is. What do you have to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a bit full on because you have to do all your tests. So you've got to do the SATs and, you know, all the American University admissions tests and these very long personal essays that are very earnest. And you have to do that all right when you're doing your HSC trials.
Oh, my goodness. Because that was so stressful enough, right?
Exactly, yeah. But then there's also a bit of a time lag. So I found out in the December after I finished year 12 that I'd gotten in, but the school year would only start in the following September. So there was sort of a 9-month period there where you, you know, have to figure out what to do. But yeah, I always say to people when they ask, you know, how did you get into Harvard, that that year there were only 6 other Australians who were applying. And so compared to all the Americans who were applying to go, I feel like the odds were a lot better for me.
How extraordinary. So hardly any Australians even try to do that path, but I guess doing the SAT and everything, it's a lot of extra work. Why Harvard in particular? What appealed to you about this this fabled place?
Well, actually, I think it's just that it was the only place that my sister had applied. She, you know, went high, and I think because it just seemed like such a crazy idea to even get in. But once she was there and she was figuring out the liberal arts system, I immediately saw that it was something that I would be interested in doing. It's a bit different to studying here where you're not choosing a specialty straight away. And so you have these 4 years where you sort of get to explore and learn a little bit about a lot of things. It's that old classical idea of a well-rounded education. And so I was taking classes in, you know, anything from Russian literature to statistics to astronomy. And then you, in second year, in the sophomore year, you pick what's called a concentration. And so I picked anthropology at that point. But yeah, it was just this amazing experience as well to live on campus for 4 years.
Yeah.
Staying in these dorms, you sleeping in these little rooms. You've got all these roommates. You eat all your meals in the dining halls. And I think, you know, in Australia, uni's not always that sort of live-in on-campus experience. It is in some cities. Mm. But, yeah, just that opportunity to have that cloistered, kind of cozy experience of being back on the campus. And I think that's why going back for the reunions is a very nostalgic experience, because you can actually choose to stay in the same dormitories where you really spent your youth.
That must be so bizarre. I mean, I live 5 minutes from the place where I went to university, and I never lived on campus, but it's a bit of a different way of doing things. But I mean, it does certainly, I've only really seen it in that particular movie. It takes you inside the dorms and you're walking through the Harvard Yard and all the quads and different pieces, you know, of this extraordinary campus. What's it like to live in history like that? Because it's older than Australia. I shouldn't say older than Australia, older than European settlement of Australia, I believe.
You know, it's sort of a pity that it happens to you when you're so young, and so that cliche that you don't really know, you know, how good you've got it. I mean, I turned up there at 18 and I knew that I was lucky, but I didn't really understand it. I feel like now that, you know, I'm approaching 40 and it's kind of sinking in that, you know, incredible gift landed on my lap when I, you know, was probably a bit too young to really fully appreciate it. And even in the sense that you're talking about, understand where, you know, its place in history. Mm. And so it's kind of been in retrospect that I have processed some of those feelings. And so going back to the reunions each time, it starts to feel more and more like a dream, like I made it up that I even went there as an 18-year-old.
How interesting.
It doesn't feel real at all anymore.
It does sound, though, as though the curriculum is kind of designed around that. You're there and they kind of give you everything you need to know to get in. I guess most Australians go there as postgrads, don't they, if they're going to go there to really American universities in general.
Yeah, I think a lot of high school students just don't know that it's even a possibility, and then they assume that it would be unaffordable. Mm. So I think what we don't know about is that, you know, most of the Ivy Leagues have these huge endowments, which, you know, for better or worse, means that they can afford to really curate the student population that they want, and they want an incredibly diverse student population. So all the assumptions, I think, also that we make about Harvard in particular as being a place of only one kind of privilege was not really my experience once I was on campus. Obviously, okay, there were pockets of that, but because of that endowment and because so many people there were on financial aid, whether they were international students or American students, it was just much more diverse and a much more interesting group and student cohort than I had also assumed before I turned up there. And then, of course, there were the Jared Kushner type, who had probably, I mean, I don't know if he actually did buy his way in there, but, you know, there were pockets of that, but you could really avoid that. If you wanted to.
Yeah, there are sort of articles about that, which I've read in the past about Jared's education. It's a fascinating insight into how America works. Natalie Portman, though, was there. I remember at the time how she suddenly stopped acting and went and studied, and I kind of thought it was a really cool thing to do. What was it like being in the same U of University as this enormous star?
Well, yeah, I had this bizarre experience where she was shooting the Star Wars films back in Sydney, and I was coming back to see my parents, you know, over the American summers. And so we were briefly friends. I feel like I stuffed up the friendship because it was just really too strange being friends with someone who was so famous. You just feel really awkward all the time. And all the questions that you normally ask a friend that you're getting to know, you can't really ask. But she actually invited me to come onto the set of the Star Wars films.
Oh, wow.
At Fox Studios in Sydney. And I really messed up because I didn't recognize George Lucas and asked him what he was doing on the set, or what do you do on the set? You know, I was nervous, just trying to be friendly. So yeah, but she was lovely. I mean, she was just, you know, in the novel, I use these two characters and they're not based on Jared or Natalie, but I did find it interesting to look at these two characters who are the sort of opposite ends of fame, the dark and the light, you know, fame and infamy. And all the characters in the book sort of orbit around them. And you never hear from those two characters, the actress character or the sort of nepotistic political son of a president. So it's really about the way that the other characters are responding to them and the way that they become a lightning rod for other people to question decisions that they've made in their life.
And I guess everyone,
as you kind of at the 15-year reunion, and there's a lot of soul searching that's starting to happen, and you're beginning to wonder if, you know, you've wasted that potential that you were told that you had, even if you didn't believe it yourself.
Caradwyn Dovey is my guest here on Nightlife. Life After Truth is her book, set in this extraordinary world of Harvard, her university. Coming from Australia as an undergraduate. And it also looks at this, I guess, the reunion experience as well. Dom Knight is my name, by the way, filling in for Indira tonight. And, I mean, reunions are such a great, I guess, catalyst for soul searching and looking back at your life. And I remember certainly in high school, you know, the early ones were hugely competitive and then it became a bit more relaxed. But, I mean, really, it's just it kind of demands that everyone take stock of what they've done, isn't it?
It does. And I think as a writer, that's why being there, I also hadn't been back to America for 10 years when I went to my 15 reunion in 2018. But all of my senses were just alive because it was this structure that, you know, I think as a novelist, you're always looking for ways to take stock of your life and other people's lives and also the time of life that you're at. And midlife is a particularly rich topic, I think, in fiction.
Yeah.
And so it just was this amazing structure that there's these people that you once used to hang around with in your pajamas and eat your breakfast with every day. And then some of them you haven't seen in 15 years. And suddenly you're having these very intimate conversations again with people. And exactly as you say, Dom, that, you know, at the 5-year reunion, there was still a lot of posturing and sort of performative achievement and things. And I didn't go to the 10-year reunion, so I'm not sure what happened there. But this time around, I was actually just blown away by the gentle kind of openness that everybody had. And they were prepared to speak about the things that were going wrong or that had gone wrong and failures and, you know, sadness and heartbreak. And everyone had just become a lot nicer. And
thank goodness.
It was really nice to see. And it sort of, you wonder what, I think that continues. And, you know, by the 60th reunion, maybe even Jared Kushner will be a nice guy.
Oh, there you go. Well, wouldn't that be interesting to find out? What made you decide to turn this formative experience into fiction? What were you hoping to explore, do you think?
Well, I had not intended to write a novel about this when I went over to that reunion, but because I just had this very emotional, kind of rich, confronting also, like not only positive, but experience being back there. And I got back to Sydney and I was horribly jet lagged and I couldn't sleep and I had a period of terrible insomnia and this book just started to kind of tumble out.
Wow.
But I think it was also linked to what I was saying about midlife. And one of the characters in the novel is a professor of happiness. So she's a Harvard undergrad who's now become a professor at Harvard. And
that's
she's
great.
Happiness, the science of happiness. And so she is always, you know, trying to give the others ways of coping, I suppose, with the difficulties of whatever it is that they are dealing with. And one of the things that she says, based on something one of her favorite philosophers says, is that you can't live the second half of your life in the same way that you've lived the first.
What an interesting thing.
It's a beautiful concept. And I think I wrote this novel because I too, like everybody, am, you know, struggling with certain things at this juncture in life and wondering, you know, what one should do differently in the second half of a life and what it means to, you know, reach a midpoint if you're lucky, I suppose.
Yeah.
I hope that in the novel, it comes from a compassionate place where I'm hoping that anybody who reads it might have a few more ideas for thinking through their own dilemmas at this time of life.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly my age group as well. I'm, I think, slightly older than you, but I feel the same thing, sort of midway through your life and you choose to do one thing, you go in one direction, you run hard, and then you kind of think, well, hang on, why did I run in this direction? Why did I do that? And the different factors that you have to try and balance. Do you want to have a family? What relationships do you have? What career do you have? How do you deal with your own legacy and your own family and all the things that visits upon you? There's a lot, isn't there? There's really a lot on the table.
There's a lot on the table. And I think the beauty of the form of a novel is that it lets you get underneath that. So, you know, everybody's dealing with that on the surface, and you kind of know, even in your own social group, you know, who's having a midlife crisis and handling it well and who isn't. But with a novel, you get to sort of peel that back another layer and get into that internal monologue and see what, you know, the gap between what people are thinking and then and saying or doing. And so for me, again, as a writer, it's just a really rich way to look at how we're all just muddling through most of the time.
That's a very good way to put it. And the notion of using, I guess, real characters, but real contemporaries of yours, but as a jumping off point, it's really, I love the way that fiction enables writers to, I guess, rather than just sort of saying what it was like for you and reporting on it as a journalist, you can somehow get to the essence of what it was like and what it was all about without being bound by real people in a way. Is that how you found dealing with those characters?
Yeah, it's very freeing. This is a bit of a different style for me. I've never written a novel quite in the same voice. And I haven't really tackled these sorts of contemporary life questions before.
Mm.
Or written a novel of, you know, modern life. But yes, it was, you know, and writers always say this and no one believes us, but it's usually the truth that these characters were entirely invented from the bottom up. But of course, they're infused with these emotions. And I put a little bit of, you know, many different kinds of things that I felt into all the different characters. So you get to spread it around, and then these things do take on a life of their own, beyond anything that you and your own little narrow experience could ever really bring to the page.
Oh, yeah, and I would totally understand that. I mean, there are novels, the Romain Clef, I think they're called, where people disguise real people in the novel, but it's in this case, you've somehow got at the essence of something different. And I guess it also sounds like you're grappling with America, and it must have been an extraordinary thing to go to such a different culture, even though it's so familiar, in sort of superficially, at the age of 18 to move there. I feel like in the past 5-6 years, Australia has become fascinated by America and American politics in a way that we weren't before. And it seems as though anyone with interest in what America's doing and how it works will find a lot on the page here in Life After Truth.
I hope so. I mean, one thing that did strike me going back, so this is 2018, so Trump had been in the presidency for just over a year, I guess, since late 2016, and just the disillusionment amongst the American friends that I had, and just the sense of some corner having been turned and this mourning that they were in, you know, for their own country. And you know, we see all of that too, but we are experiencing it a little bit as outsiders. And I've always still felt like an outsider there, obviously, even after having that intense experience on campus. And so, yeah, it was, I think in the novel, all of the characters are American that I've created. And so it was also a way to reflect on the grief, I think, of what many Americans are going through, of feeling that, you know, they've lost something that can never be gotten back, really.
How do you feel about the place? Do you feel that it doesn't live up to its promise in some respect? We all know the self-perception of America, the land of freedom and opportunity, the best country in the world, they kept saying during this campaign. Do you feel that it sometimes falls short of its I guess mythology?
Of course it does. But you know, someone famous said this, and I can never remember who. But everything you could say about America is true. You know, it's so vast, and it's so complex, and I mean, yeah, it's a hard thing to say. I have very warm, wonderful, you know, feelings towards the country because it gave me this gift, essentially. And then through those years, you know, my American friends were welcoming me into their homes for Thanksgiving and spring breaks. And, you know, just there's nothing like that kind of American generosity. I've never experienced that anywhere else in the world. So there are these wonderful things, of course, about the culture, like any culture. But I think, again, we also tend to now, you know, only see it through the lens of its corrupt leaders and, you know, forget that it is this huge country that is just filled with all kinds of people. And those leaders are not speaking for those people. And so I think that's what's very sad, you know, is having seen the best of America and the just the kindness of the people that I knew very well and my closest friends from that time. And then to feel like, you know, we sort of putting them all in the same category as their leaders.
Yeah, I mean, someone said to me once, because America is, there are more than 10 times the people in Australia, you know, anything you can think of is abundant there. There are people far to the left of everyone here. There's far to the right of everyone here. It's any possible group is in abundance due to the sheer numbers, which I guess is what you're saying as well. In the past hour of our show, we were actually talking about tutoring and the world of elite universities. Later in the show, we're going to be actually heading to the US and talking about the election. So everything's tying in beautifully for us tonight. I just wonder, finally, how you feel about Harvard at this point. Your sister figured out that she could get in. She went there. You did as well. It sounds absolutely wonderful, but also it is, of course, such an elitist. It is at the absolute top of society. You're with people who go on to run the world. That's kind of the mission of the place in a way. How do you feel about that now, having gone to somewhere that is, I guess, just not the norm? Does that feel strange at this distance?
Well, actually, I think it was a really useful lesson in just learning that, you know, at an early age, that everybody, even those kids who were at Harvard, you know, it wasn't like they were smarter than people I was at, you know, high school with here or just knew. You know, so much about just the luck of the draw, but then also having, you know, been, I suppose, pushed in that direction. And it gave me a sense that anything is possible because you are seeing that, you know, you can be in these classes and you can speak up and it's okay. You know, you're not going to just turn into, you're not just going to turn into, you know, nothing in that room by opening your mouth. And so this being forced to speak up in that way as a young woman was very empowering. And the message that you were being given, you know, to believe in yourself. And again, we like to make fun of Americans for that, you know, that you can do anything sort of stuff. But it was really refreshing to actually be told that as a young woman.
Yeah.
To not be afraid of whatever it was that you were talented at.
And like all great writers, you've taken the experience, you've chewed on it for 15 or so years, and all this time later, it's turned into a book. Well, Akridwin, thank you so much for telling us about Life After Truth. I've already got texts here saying I can't wait to read this, and thank you so much for sharing it with us here on Nightlife.
Thank you, Dom.
Akridwin Dovey, the novel is Life After Truth.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.